I've never said anything about the chairman.
He never leaves.
Never leaves.
No, the construction president.
The king is dead. Long live the king.
Well, we never show that Mr. Chandler comes back, though.
No, we just look at the no votes.
Section 12, Roger.
Compounding. A person commits the crime of compounding if he accepts or agrees to accept any pecuniary benefit upon an agreement or understanding that, one, he refrain from initiating prosecution for a crime, or two, he conceal from law enforcement authorities information relating to the commission of a crime.
We approve section 12.
Well, the motion has been made. Is there any discussion?
Section 1, bribery.
Pardon?
Mr. Chairman, I was going to mention one less than that. Some guy throws a brick through a window, and he gets nailed, and he says, I'll pay for the window and any damage and everything else, and we'll just call it square.
That's compromise. We have that. We have in section 134, we have chapter 134, we have a provision for compromising misdemeanors.
But it isn't in here.
We'll put it in procedure.
You're not violating this law in there.
No. No.
Well, didn't we put an exception in this section here?
Well,
except as provided in the code.
Yes.
Still with bribery?
Might be. Depends on your definition of bribery.
Isn't there
some case decision or something like say that a person writes a $25 a check. Get into the felony situation. And so the person comes and pays off the check. So they only get to what he's entitled to. That should not be the compounding felony. But if he makes him pay him $150 when the check is only for $100 to get him to agree not to prosecute, that then would come under the compounding. It seemed like when we were.
Many times I have an argument about how much it's coming.
Yeah, and I remember they had a case in the room with a law clerk down there, and a guy that stole a boat.
The boat
was stolen, and imagine the boat was worth, had been, say, for sale for $1,000 or something, and the boat dealer made him pay him $1,500 and agreed not to prosecute. And then they were charging him under the compounding of a felony situation. That clearly was compounding a felony.
We used to have an old JP over at Dallas that was running the collection business as well as being a JP, and he was always trying to charge people with them. He had to cry if they wouldn't pay the bill.
Well, we had one that sent out notices with his official title and everything else. Your last notice, unless you pay the amount of so-and-so and so-and-so, a complaint will be filed against you, signed Justice of the Peace.
he did it over there. He did it over in the case where a guy wouldn't pay his rent to the landlord, fixed something about a house that he was renting. And the guy came in when I was at the end. I told him to ask for a jury and he'll be all right. And so one of the things that was wrong with the house he wanted to fix was the toilet seat was busted. And so I told him to get up there in front of the jury and demonstrate how that toilet seat wouldn't work. And the jury just laughed the whole damn thing out of court, and the JP didn't do that anymore.
I wonder, Chairman.
I've seen it. It's a primation story. In case of the missing toilet seat.
Does the key in subsection 1 refer to non-officials?
No, it refers to everybody.
It refers to officials and non-officials.
And I suggest duplicating what we've done in earlier drafts and connection with.
Not bribery.
Bribery. Bribery or whatever. Because.
You don't mean bribing a witness?
Obstructing governmental administration or something like that. I forget which area it is, but. In other words, if you go to the DA and say, here's $100, if you don't prosecute X, I would imagine that we have that covered under some other chapter.
Well, look at section 2 on page 6.
Well, let's look at my hand.
And then, sub 2, doesn't that relate to section A on page 40? Concealing information relating?
Page 40 of what?
Of this draft, where we talked about tampering with physical evidence. No, I guess not. It's a little bit different.
I thought we were giving a bribe or receiving a bribe. That's where you bribe some public servant to act in a manner that's in violation of his duties. I forget the language.
We're talking about in compounding about deals made between private parties. Not involving.
Well, this is what I think of this is what bothers me about some of the language here. That's what you talk about, but it sure doesn't read that way. And indeed, he refrained from initiating prosecution for a crime.
Correct.
But usually, the only person that initiates prosecution is the district attorney.
No. The complainant.
Well, they both initiate in one sense of the word. The complainant signs it, but the DA makes the papers out and all that.
It's officially done by the complainant.
Well, but the only point I want to make is that we ought to make it clear one way or another. I don't care.
Would it be adequate if the commentary were to show that this refers to non-officials?
Well, provided that was what the subcommittee intended.
Well, if a DA or anybody else from initiating for a pecuniary benefit, he ought to be guilty of something. He's guilty of something else. But
yeah,
that doesn't hurt.
Because he's a public servant.
Yeah, then wouldn't he be under the other article?
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be overlapping, as to him.
Yeah, and I don't think it should be overlapping.
It may be a lesser crime, for all I know.
Don, Roger, what is your response to that?
Well,
you may have some overlapping.
Well, that's why I think public officials ought to be exempted.
What we're really talking about, I guess one of the cases under compounding here is a police officer accepting $5, not
to issue a ticket. Not to issue a ticket.
Public servant. But really what compounding is, and is the model penal code and the
here,
New York revised statute has, makes it an affirmative defense if the amount asked for or received did not exceed the amount to which the act was believed to be due as restitution or indemnification for the harm caused.
Right, and we had that in our original draft that went to the subcommittee. And we have similar language in our theft by extortion. We provided defense there, similar type language. And we felt that it should be here, frankly, I did. But the subcommittee felt that it complicated the issue by allowing this defense. And the minutes of the subcommittee point out that we discussed under theft by extortion, it is a defense that the defendant reasonably believed the threatened charge to be true, and that his sole purpose was to compel or induce the victim to take reasonable action to make good the wrong which was the subject of the threatened charge. And that was to take care of these compromised situations.
And the demand letters and that type. Well, but bribe receiving says a public servant commits the crime of bribe receiving if he accepts or agrees to accept any pecuniary benefit upon an agreement or understanding that his
judgment, action, decision, or exercise of discretion as a public servant will thereby be influenced.
I think the model penal code is a better, in better language.
If I accept a pecuniary benefit, and I'm the DA in Benton County, on the understanding or agreement that I refrain from prosecuting Chandler, I would be under this section, and I'd also be under this one. Absent some commentary that would remove me, and I don't think I ought to be under both sections.
Well,
look at page 79.
Prosecution under one would be raised due to kinda primary temper.
Really, what we're talking about here is we're talking about the individual who's had a crime committed upon him.
Yeah.
The victim of a crime, and saying, if you don't pay me this amount of money, I'm going to go in and file a complaint.
Why can't we put language like that in that first sentence?
Or in a subsection 3 and say this does not relate to public servants or something.
Mr. Chairman?
Think for you.
I would move to use the language in the model penal. Instead of saying a person commits a misdemeanor, say a person commits the crime of compounding if he accepts the penal.
According to the law enforcement authorities, the commission is suspect. And then this gets it. I mean, if a store owner has received a bum check, so he goes out and collects it, and the guy says, "Well, are you going to go to the police with this then?" And the store owner says, "No. Got his money and he's satisfied." Well, then the store owner is going to be guilty of compounding. But if he goes out and says, "Well, you got to pay me double the amount, otherwise I'm going in," then he would be compounding.
The second promotion of amendment.
So the model penal code, he reports it, and then the DA should come back tomorrow and have a complaint ready and pay off in the meantime. It wouldn't be a crime if the model penal code.
Well, are we? I don't know. Guy says, "You pay me, or I'm going to prosecute you." Okay. The glass company says it costs $50 to replace that window. Yeah, but it's worth $100 to me for that special kind of glass in there or something. Okay, it's an affirmative defense that the amount he received didn't exceed an amount which he reasonably believed to be due.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I suggest we first take up the one thing at a time, and so I'll amend my motion to have it read in this way. I am movably delete the language in section 12 as it stands and insert the following language. Person commits crime of compounding if he accepts or agrees to accept any pecuniary benefit in consideration of refraining from reporting to law enforcement authorities the commission or suspected commission of any offense or information relating to an offense, period. And then we can take up the question of the affirmative defense of the secondary matter. But that covers, I think, what is in the original section 12.
What if it's a crime under our definition of an offense?
Is that consistent, that language, with the language you've used throughout the code?
Yeah, that would be all right.
You've heard the motion. Discussion?
Well, yeah, I'd like to ask a question, if I may. Does Don or Roger have any feeling that the amendment language would be any substantial difference from what you have there now?
Well, I think that it would help clarify the question you raised about the public service. And I think that's probably good, although I don't think that it's necessarily bad that an individual by one transaction may violate more than one criminal statute. I don't think that makes the statute bad, but But just to clarify it, I think that would be good to use reporting rather than initiating a prosecution.
Well, yeah, you're going to make Frank's amendment to your thing?
What was Frank's?
Crime or offense.
Oh, all right, yeah.
Did you get that language? No, did you got it?
It will read the commission of any crime or offense or information relating to it.
Well, we don't need both.
Well,
if we have used crime, then it limits it to felonies and misdemeanors. If we use offense, it takes in everything.
Oh, does it?
It does,
yes.
Offense under our definition.
Well, I thought offense was something less than a misdemeanor.
No,
that's a violation.
Oh,
that's right.
And offense includes felonies, misdemeanors, and violations.
Yes.
But a crime just includes felonies and misdemeanors.
Restate my motion in its original form.
What is a crime?
Offense. In other words, I've just taken the language out of the first sentence of the model penal code, except that commits the crime of compounding in lieu of a misdemeanor.
And of course, the effect of that means that you could commit the crime of compounding a violation. And so you should understand that. That's what you're doing. Okay.
You could put a nickel in the guy's parking meter.
You're compounding a violation.
Question. Call for the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Mr. Johnson, I want to congratulate you. That's the first motion I recall that you've made that's passed. Today.
I haven't made any motions today. So drop dead. I've done a lot of talking and it's useless. But I count.
Now, how about the defense?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as Bruce suggested, if we're going to have a compromise section relating to misdemeanor, might it not be appropriate to say, except as provided in section blank, and then go into what has been, what we just passed upon, and then leave this current defense business out?
Require him to get a court-approved compromise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Except as provided in section blank, which we'll come to when we get to the procedure. Then, as the model penal code says.
Why should he be required to get a court-approved compromise?
Because I think that
the complaint has already been filed in that type of a situation. You see.
Yeah, you're right.
In other words, it's something that where the court, the victim can dismiss against the district attorney.
Yeah, I see. It's already filed. Yeah.
But those crimes are never reported. Are often not reported. I'm not too sure they should.
But that doesn't take care of your guy who gets the bad check, who hasn't gone to the DA.
Yeah, if the complaint has not yet been filed,
that's right.
He agrees not to go to the police, he's still guilty. He doesn't have this. There's a certain number of felonies that are quite, you might say, personal between the victim and the defendant, and if the victim wants to take what to do him,
and if he's satisfied, why not let him do it?
Yeah.
Well, let's put it in here then.
Hold the guy up. That's the difference.
What, this defense?
Yeah.
Well, suppose the situation is that I know this does occur. The employee of the company embezzles $50,000. Bonding company works out an agreement with him. What they do is they hound those guys for life. It's really almost a form of blackmail.
Until he's paid.
Huh?
Until he's paid, repaid them.
Yeah. They do not report it. The crime has occurred. Yet this guy has committed a fairly serious crime.
They can only hound him for 3 years.
Oh, so a statute runs off.
You didn't think of that.
Yeah, but they shouldn't be invited to hound him at all, either collect from him or not, but the public has an interest in
prosecuting
or not prosecuting.
This guy is a serious crime of major proportions. Very likely got a propensity to do it again.
And his only reason for not reporting it is usually a better hope of collecting a benefit to the bonding company.
That's why I don't think the defense comes either.
Well, what are you going to do about the bad check charges? The fellow gives you a bad check for $15,
$20. Well, I suppose what I read, again, is a kind of prosecutor.
The fact of the business is that it goes on all the time. Has.
Yeah.
And it will continue to go on.
Yeah.
Regardless of what.
And nobody will ever prosecute it.
Well, Chairman, this is what I'm getting at.
Back to this old prosecutor's discretion.
Well, how about the old typical one of Halloween and the kids come in and, you know, tip over the outhouse or knock down the clothesline and this sort of stuff. And the father finds out about it and calls up the phone and says, I'm afraid my boy did this sort of stuff. Trespassed, damage to property, whatever comes under now. And he's going to work Saturday to pay you back. Boom, the guy agrees to that. Has he not just committed a crime of compounding it? Now, maybe that doesn't happen very often, but it just seems to me that that kind of stuff happens a lot more than
that. That seems to me that it shouldn't be a crime to accept
it happens
law
a lot.
Not entitled to. Anymore, it is.
There is something bad about agreeing not to prosecute. It's all right to agree to let your boy come over here and fix it. I think it should be up to the public as to whether this conduct requires prosecution or whether it doesn't.
So it's not going to have any prosecution
because the recipient of the boy's services is not going to deliver.
You would if that guy'd call his lawyer and say, the one to whom the property was damaged, say, look, I got a problem.
It's costing more to get to pay the lawyer than to put up a new clothesline.
You won't do that.
Well, we might put that to bail too, for free. But the lawyer would be.
Unless his lawyer's his next door neighbor like Bruce doesn't take a vacation in Honolulu.
I think it's better to have him in there.
The defense?
Yeah.
One of the ones we have, Mr. Chairman, is on the college campuses where the students are now facing a problem, and maybe we don't even want to get into that, but right now they have their own disciplinary, sort of their kangaroo courts that hear a lot of things that perhaps they shouldn't hear, I grant you that are truly crimes, but they treat them as violations of rules and regulations on the campus, and only when it becomes severe do they get outside. Technically then, of course, the full board is reporting. Advisory committee is perhaps compounding accepting a pecuniary benefit.
No 40-year-old man should try to learn how to ski.
Ooh.
Turn up your pacemaker, Tony. That's what I don't like.
Can I make a distinction with between monetary amounts and our theft section?
Not yet, we haven't. No.
Well, it makes the DA collection agency.
And New York gave us as much thought as we have, and they finally concluded that was the right
thing. They're not as smart as we are.
Well, the only thing is, I can see the relatively small offense. This is a. Probably should be maybe a defense.
Well, should we confine this to misdemeanors?
What?
Confine it to misdemeanors.
No, that was the reason I was asking about the theft provision, because I didn't know what the main distinctions in there by amount.
No, we talked about the amount.
You only compound a felony, don't you?
Yeah.
As long as it's a misdemeanor, you don't compound.
Yeah, you let him live and smoke for a time, you don't see what it's that out, but not a big one.
Not a big one, man.
Of course, maybe the thing to do is put in a defense if it's a crime less than a felony.
Either that or limit the crime of compounding to felons and not allow the defense.
Well, that's the way it is now.
No, because we've got offense in there, and that would include felonies, misdemeanors.
No, but I mean, that's the present law.
Oh, present law, yeah, yeah.
That might be a solution.
I have a question.
You have a technical question?
No, I have a motion. Is the section still open to amendment?
Yep.
Yes.
All right. I move to amend to strike the word offense and to insert the word felony in both instances in which it appears in the section that's presently amended. You also amended the circles as
felony. Just make it a point.
Change it to felony and then not bother with the defense.
Well, I would be in favor of doing that as a lesser of two evils, but I'm not in favor of doing it in defense.
What about then, would we have any law on that would cover the situation where a guy's written a $5 NSF check and the store owner says, you pay me $10 or $25 or I'm going to go down.
Extortion, third guy extortion.
We got him under extortion then, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, can I move?
There's already a motion before.
Well, I'd like to move to amend his motion just to get the question before.
All right.
Did you get that note? What I would like to do is to leave the section the way we've got it now and permit the defense, but limit the defense to felonies, to misdemeanors.
Well, that's what we're...
No, he limits the crime to felonies.
You want the way around?
Right.
Let the crime go to everything, but limit the defense to misdemeanors.
And offensive violations.
Well,
we got plenty to do without running around prosecuting guys who compound a misdemeanor.
I think so.
Yeah, but what if you got a guy that come to town and write 3 dozen $25 checks, and then as soon as somebody starts prosecuting him, he goes around and pays everybody back their $25, and the DA can't prosecute him.
Yes, he can.
Oh, well, sure. He can.
Unless the judge will let him off the hook. That is, if we've got our hands on a check. If we haven't got our hands on a check, then of course he can.
We've got a defense if we...
Oh, but we're looking at the...
The store owner would have a defense.
The merchant store owner. If it's only
the check writer wouldn't have a defense there.
Oh, that's fine.
I'll go on.
Mr. Chairman, I will go along with this to change it to felony, strike out the defense as the lesser of the two evils. And I think that we're going to get to the situation with respect to compromising misdemeanors in the procedural section, and we can approach that issue then. But I think this is a middle ground.
You're a really bad guy.
Does everyone understand the motion? All in favor say aye.
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 Carry.
I move we approve it as amended.
Any further discussion? Call a roll on adoption of section 12 as amended.
Judge Green.
Aye.
Judge Green.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Kent.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Spalding.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
I move the adoption of 13.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to mention now that just so the commission will have it in mind that we ought to probably take another look at our theft by extortion defense that we've provided there. We don't necessarily have to do it now, but because we have allowed such a defense to theft by extortion in this compromise situation. So
if you will remind the commission of that, we will.
Okay.
Section 13.
What do you mean?
Any further discussion on 13?
What is
that? Call the roll.
Judge Green?
Aye.
Zenderberg?
He thought he was a guy.
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Chen?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Then there's an inconsistency.
Pauling.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye.
Carrie.
I just wanted to comment.
Is there any way you could make a sharp inconsistency?
I'm trying to keep track of.
I brought this up so many minutes about this stuff.
What you trying to do?
Get a motion on section 14. Simulation. Discussion. Call roll.
Judge Grant.
Aye.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Pauling.
Aye.
Now, Don, do you think we can get anywhere with communications?
Well,
not this group.
I think you might.
We'll get to the middle.
We could just take time maybe to discuss some of these materials that we sent out to you, which was really in the way of background information as a result of our last meeting. And I hope all of you got those. And they're also in your books here under your white tab at the beginning of your book. We have a copy there of. From the U.S. Code Title 18, Chapter 11, dealing with the federal statutes on conflict of interest. That was requested by Mr. Paul. And then we also have Chapter 119, which is the codification of the State Streets and Crime Control Act, Title 3, related to communication and wiretaps. That's set out in your book. And then we have a section also copies of the Michigan Conflict of Interest Statute that was brought up at the last commission meeting in connection with the conflict of interest. Today, if depending on the wishes of the commission, rather than getting back this conflict of interest thing, I think it might be well to discuss this communications proposal first, because we do have some amendments that we've prepared. They're in your book. Under your, right after the section, the original draft on wiretap, we have a green tab there on amendments. And now these amendments up through section 8. Make amendments that were approved by the commission at its last meeting with respect to the substantive area of eavesdropping. And those are set out. And then beginning with section 9, we have all of these new amendments, which are patterned after the new New York procedural code. Except for one or two instances where we haven't followed New York because we felt it went beyond the requirements of the Safe Streets and Crime Control Act. But I think that we have to meet the requirements of Title III of that act in order to have any kind of meaningful wiretap provisions, assuming that we want to provide for wiretap by statute. And terms of the Crime Control Act are very specific as to what you have to show in your affidavits, all the hoops that you have to jump through to get your warrant for eavesdropping in the first place. So whether or not you have time to go through all these or not, but I did want to call them to your attention so that if you don't want to take them up today, you have a chance to examine them more carefully before the next week.
Well, I just doubt very much.
I don't think we get any place with them.
I think it's such a complicated area.
Yeah,
it is. It's a tough
I want to be fresh.
You have to start thinking again.
Yeah. Well,
you know, it really taxes the subcommittee members, I think, when we meet tonight before. Don't you think so?
Yeah.
Do you? Yeah.
Well, we're already tired from a day's work the night before.
And then
we're down here at 7 o'clock, yeah. Work till 11 or so.
And it kind of poops you out for Friday's meeting. I don't think we'll try it again.
Now, I've noticed you guys kind of slow today.
All those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
By the way, Mr. Chairman, before we get into business, I want to make sure that the record shows that when Representative Frost announced his retirement from the legislature, that it was the paper and not his press release that described this group as a criminal law evasion committee.
Irrespective of Senator Lent's distribution of that.
Yeah, statewide distribution.
Senator Lent wasn't alone. Sometimes we feel that the work of this commission is little noticed by the public, but I assure you that isn't true. I received 14. The first matter that we're going to consider concerns a oral presentation by the Oregon Kennedy Action Corps. In making the presentation, I want you to assume, which is correct, that the members of the commission have read and studied the excellent written presentation or proposal to the Criminal Law Revision Commission for Firearms Control Legislation in Oregon. And I understand that Mr. Paylette has made arrangements to allow you 20 minutes to make a further verbal presentation. Also, someone is here, Mr. Lee Crawford, I believe, who wishes some time to be heard on this matter. The reason for restricting you to this amount of time, I'm sure you appreciate, is twofold. First, we do have your written presentation. I understand that you did appear before a subcommittee. And lastly, you are in somewhat of a preferred position because there are very, very few who have had the opportunity of making verbal presentations before this commission as a whole. Normally, the procedure is for the witnesses, if any, to appear before the subcommittee. I understand that that Dr. James Sullivan will make the presentation, and that also present are Mrs. Perry, who incidentally I understand prepared this excellent brochure, and Mrs. Terry Finn and Dolores Sather are present to answer questions if members of the commission have any such questions.
Mr. Finn.
Pardon?
Mr. Finn.
Oh, I beg your pardon, it's Mr. Well, they're doing everything else these days. I've done it too. Dr. Sullivan, would you come forward? And if you wish, you may sit at that chair at the corner there.
Thank you very much, Senator. And I do appreciate the opportunity to hear today and to talk with you about this problem. To answer any questions, and I can assure you that 20 minutes will be quite ample. I am going on the assumption that the time that's been given, you have had an opportunity to read the report, and therefore what I would simply like to do is talk about some of the highlights and directions and some justifications, and then respond to any questions that you might like to present to it. But it seems to me that this is the sort of a problem that we have to address ourselves to. When we recognize the tremendous number of deaths that are occurring from guns, handguns, rifles, and so forth, when we recognize that since 1900, more people have been killed by guns than in all of the war, or to look at it from another way, if you look at the fact that today, one of the most divisive factors in American life is the Vietnamese War and the deaths it is causing. We average out the deaths in Vietnam, they come to something like 9,000 a year in those years in which we have really been involved. And yet, at the same time, we are in effect killing 20,000 people, more than twice as many every year, here in America, with guns. It seems to me that we have to weigh these. And obviously, Vietnam has at a cost, and I'm not suggesting these are actions entirely even. But I think that the impact of these deaths is one that we have to recognize. I think we have to recognize that we are getting to the point where it is not a declining or even a steady problem, but it is an increasing problem in America today. And I think one of the significant facts from this report shows that since 1964, the use of firearms and murders is up 71%. In armed robberies, it's up 113%. an aggravated assault of 117. I think one thing we're faced with then is the fact that the condition is getting worse. The question is whether or not the society is going to do something to try to halt it. I think one of the other areas we have to simply look at is what happens when people have guns. What's the impact? I think another one of the significant facts to bring to your attention again is the fact that guns are 7 times more deadly in assaults than all other weapons combined. Now, we have had explosive people. We've had people who probably should not have any sort of a weapon available. But I think the interesting thing is that if you take all other weapons, they get mad and stab you or club you or do whatever the case, 3% of these attacks result in deaths. But when people have guns available, 21% of the assaults with guns result in deaths. And that is, it seems to me that I'm not sure all of you have seen the bumper sticker say, guns don't kill people, people kill people. But I think the significance of the facts indicate that it's people with guns who kill people. It's with guns that makes the difference. We've gone in less than any number of other of these statistics that you've had a chance to read. But I think that what is happening in the United States is that a serious problem is becoming worse in the passage of each year. And one of the problems, and it's one that we're willing to admit at the very beginning, is that nobody really knows some of the statistics and facts as to how many guns are out there. Federal government made their survey, and it's an estimate on their part. Their estimate was that there were 90 million guns in existence in the United States. Lee Johnson, the Attorney General, responded to a letter recently in which his best information was that there was 200 million guns in private hands at the present time. I think one of the problems we face is that without licensing, without registration, almost anybody's guess, whether it's 90 million or 200 million, we don't know. We don't know who have. And this is one of the reasons, then, that we are advocating that some sort of effective legislation would be passed. I don't really think there's any sense in going into any great detail with this particular group in regard to constitutionality. I sometimes, talking to lay groups, elaborate on it, but I think all of the people in this particular one recognize that really there is nothing in the Second Amendment which would prevent a state legislative body from taking action. And I think that anything which is even halfway carefully written at state level certainly meets the qualifications of passing in regard to the Oregon Constitution. Certainly, the Oregon Constitution would require that there has to be some sort of legislative intent, but I think that would be very easy to accomplish. That the provisions could not be arbitrary or capricious, and I would hope that would not be any problem. So that what we would recommend then is a series proposals written into legislation. First of all, we're certainly recommending as much as possible total coverage. That is, it would apply to persons who are newly acquiring firearms, as well as people who currently own them. And when we talk about newly acquiring, we would hope that this would apply not alone to those who buy from responsible dealers, but for private exchanges as well. That it would cover all transfers. So there would be a licensing provision, which would in effect give some sort of criterion where the state could decide the suitability of persons who desire, they desire to own firearms. At the present time, almost anybody in the state can have a gun, regardless. And I think all of us recognize that there are probably a great many people who have both the legitimate need and have the suitable temperament to own guns and use them with wisdom. But at the present time, there's no control, no regulation. Third, we would recommend that there would be registration of guns, of all firearms. That this registration would be automatic for anyone who was a holder of the license. There wouldn't be, in effect, double jeopardy there. Once you have the license, you would have the right to have the gun. But the gun would be registered, so that the law enforcement agencies would have a record, and in case of crimes, in case the gun was used in the crime, would be able to check it. We would recommend that within the law that there be provisions set up for revoking that license, so that if a person was eligible at one time and then because of his actions fell into a prohibited category, he might have the revoked. If he used the firearms he had in an illegal manner, it could be revoked. If he lent his permit so that somebody else who was not eligible to buy it could be revoked. In other words, there would be provisions which would say that the state, having given a license, could then take it back. We would recommend a waiting period between the sale and delivery of firearms. We would recommend that there be provisions for at least preliminary basic education of persons who would get a license. That is, they would be advised of the state and federal law. And as complicated as they are, I'm sure you've looked into the problem. This in itself is one of the factors that we stress, as well as the fact that there should be at least reminders of what are some of the provisions for a safe gun handling. Then obviously there would have to be some sort of decision as to what penalties, legal penalties, fines and or imprisonments would be placed upon this, and the possibility of restrictions on the placing of sales of guns. And I think that the report certainly amply indicates that there is an effectiveness when you have strong gun control law. Now, we're not in the least suggesting to you that this sort of a law, any way it would be written, would make it impossible for criminals to obtain guns. But we do believe it would make it more difficult for them to obtain. Secondly, it would mean that criminals can be convicted before they commit violent crimes simply for illegal possession of firearms. This gives the law enforcement agencies another tool with which to work. And I think that without going into the details, because you have them available, we've had an opportunity to read them, I would simply remind you of those figures on page 33 of the report, in which they are talking about the effectiveness of other countries that have these guns. Because they were not total, and I don't know if you're busy time and you have time to total it, I just want to, for a moment, stress the differences in the rates, however, that these show. In the United States, we have a population of around 200 million. These countries that we were using here as examples of other countries that have strong, stringent gun control have a total population of about 377, roughly 2-to-1. But if you take homicides in the times that we have these comparable figures, in the United States, homicides with firearms ran 6,855. In the same years, the homicide with firearms in all of these other countries with twice the population ran 696, about 1/10. And roughly, although not quite as high a ratio, the same is true with suicides and the same is true with accidents. Now, I'm the last to suggest also that just the gun law is what makes a difference. I think all of us recognize that there are cultural differences and all of the rest. But I don't think there is any question that this is one of the factors which influences the saving of very many lives. And I think that this is something which has, I hope, become something acceptable by now. Certainly it is supported by the International Association of Chiefs of Police and received the support of the three presidential commissions, the Crime Commission, the Kerner Commission, and the National Commission on Causes and Prevention of Violence, have all strongly proposed firearm legislation. And I think the significant thing is that they recognize that the problem is getting worse, and that with each of these three succeeding committees, they have recommended stronger and stronger control. The FBI and J. Edgar Hoover both recommend action be taken in this area. And I noticed the other day that Edgar Eisenhower went on record much, much stronger than even the commission we had advocated. Well, in effect, then, we're talking about is licensing and registration. And licensing is not really that unusual, as all of you are aware. Licensed automobiles, licensed driver, licensed pets, licensed drugs. A number of you are attorneys, and you and are licensed. Doctors are licensed. Teachers are licensed. We license ourselves to get married. We're not, therefore, suggesting something that's totally unusual. We think that it is a valid first step. We believe that now is the time. We certainly earnestly suggest and encourage you to take action on what we think is a very vital issue.
Are there any questions?
In a facetious way, Jim, you weren't suggesting that there's an analogy between acquiring a wife and acquiring a firearm, were you?
Oh, I'm not entirely sure. I think both of them can be equally dangerous. But I think the same thing could also be said, that because we license marriages, we don't want to abolish it. Because we suggest that we license guns, nobody's suggesting then they all be abolished. I think it's a matter of control. But I would say to answer in the same tenor, yeah, they're about equally dangerous. And I think we ought to both be handled with care.
I agree.
Do you guys work often this way? Got a nightclub thing going.
The death rate in marriages is far greater than the guns.
We are the most underpaid duo in show business.
Any further questions of a serious nature? Don?
Dr. Solomon, at the, well, perhaps I should address this question to Mrs. Perry, but at the subcommittee we've discussed a specific proposal or whether or not the Kennedy Action Corps had a specific set of bills or a bill that you wish to present to the commission. If you have such a specific recommendation as far as model legislation is concerned,
well, there are two or three that are excellent sample bills. The National Council of Mayors, excellent bill. The bill we introduced last year is good, that we made some changes in it. Illinois has a good bill. We did not try, I know those are lawyers and those draft legislators, we didn't try to, for this meeting, draft a whole new bill. But there are bills already in existence. All of them have different.
New Jersey, I think, has one of the strongest bill grounds.
It's very, very complicated.
I think it's 30 years.
Any further questions? No, thank you very much, Doug.
Thank you, sir.
Are there any questions of either Mrs. Perry or Mr. Finn or Mrs. Sather? No, thank you. I imagine this is the appropriate time to hear from Mr. Lee Caldwell?
Lee Crawford.
Crawford, pardon me.
I might say that I was asked by the Oregon State Rifle and Pistol Association to appear here and make a oral presentation. Probably, since I'm not acquainted with several of you, I should give you some idea of my background. I was born on an Oregon farm where my father's gun was not a sporting weapon, but an implement of husbandry. And I learned to use a gun just as casually as I learned to use an axe. I had a gun since I was 6, owned one of my own since I was 9, and have used guns ever since, both as sporting weapons and as utility tools. Now, I don't disagree 100% with the professor, but I think his approach is perhaps not the right one. I will have some suggestions, which I hope you will find to be constructive. Now, he first talks of registration of guns. Well, it would seem to me our first approach to a registration problem is determine as far as we can the magnitude of the problem, the cost of it, and to weigh it against the possible gain. Now, of course, if gun registration would wipe out crime in Oregon, why, certainly we would do it without any questions. But obviously it won't. The most heinous crime ever committed in Marion County, Trudeau's case, didn't involve a gun in any way. To approach that problem, I'd like to point out to you that in 1968, 359,011 hunting licenses were issued. Now, also that in the 1969 legislature, Captain Howard of the Oregon State Police estimated that if Oregon passed a law requiring individual permits,
about 500,000 would be required. Now, based on those figures, we ought to get some idea of, if we're registered guns, how many guns are going to be registered, how much it's going to cost. My own estimate, and I'm very frank to say it's just an estimate, probably in the neighborhood of 1.5 million guns in Oregon. I'm basing that on about 3 guns to each individual that has and uses guns, namely a shotgun, 22 rifle, and a powered rifle. Now, perhaps the best way, I'm going to get the figures, but I'm sure they'd be available at this committee. What it costs the state to register a bolt, that's a relatively new department. Going to register guns, we're going to have to set up the machinery to do it. Be rather comparable to the cost of the bolt registration. I'm told that it costs the state about $3 out of each $10 license for a car. So I think we're talking about an expense of around $3 or $4 million to register the guns in Oregon, and a continuing expense to keep them registered. Now, let's weigh that against the possible gain. I'm sure my guns would work just as well as sporting weapons if they were registered. They'd work just as well for robbery, murder, or any other purpose, registered or unregistered. As far as registration of guns, keeping them out of the hands of the criminal element, obviously it won't. Very frank to say that given a half hour, saw a file, 2 pieces of pipe, I could create an entirely effective gun for any criminal purpose. Now, I might say too that I've discussed this with the Oregon State Police. They do not recommend firearm registration. On the other hand, they do not oppose it. They treat it as a legislative problem and haven't taken any definite stand on it. Now, when you weigh the cost of gun registration against any possible gain, I don't think we've accomplished anything. Now, I do have some suggestions of things I feel this committee should consider. That I think would be helpful. Now, ORS 166.290 provides that any sheriff or chief of police can issue a permit to carry a concealed weapon. If the sheriff issues it, they're filed with the county clerk of his county. If the chief of police issues it, they are filed with in his own office. In other words, there is no central filing, and it's almost an impossibility for the state police to determine who has and who does not have a permit to carry a concealed weapon. Central filing would take care of that, and would also give them an opportunity to check what information they have with respect to the individual to see if, in their opinion, he's a proper person to have such a permit. Now, under the present law, there's no provision for revoking the permit. Probably should be. I would go right along with the theory that any time a circuit judge feels a permit to carry a concealed weapon for a certain individual, I feel it should be. Now, the present law also specifies make and serial number of the weapon. I feel it probably should be the license to carry a concealed weapon, one having a license, not restricted to any particular gun. Now, I might mention, too, that I was admitted to practice law in 1928. I practiced in Oregon in Salem continuously since that time. While my practice has not run particularly in the line of criminal law, I have been exposed to a large number of cases involving unlawful use of firearms, robberies, and things of that sort. And I think I can fairly tell you that in a great many of these cases, the gun used is the fruits of a prior burglary, either by that particular defendant or somebody else. I can fairly say, too, that the number of guns, and particularly handguns, that are floating around in the seamy side of town where they're available to a criminal are for the most part stolen guns. I think it would be very well for this committee to seriously consider a special law covering theft of a firearm. Of course, it is covered under the larceny burglary statutes, but a specific law making theft of a firearm or knowingly receiving and concealing a stolen firearm a special law with an enhanced penalty. What I'm trying to do here now is to drive at the people that we're really after, that is the criminal element, to abuse the use of firearms. There is a matter which is a constant embarrassment to district attorney's offices. We have a law now which provides that a gun used in violation of game laws is subject to being confiscated. But one brought in on attempted suicide, threatening to commit a felony, a number of other things which show them to be emotionally unstable people who shouldn't have a gun, there's no provision whereby that gun can be confiscated. If you can imagine the embarrassment of the district attorney's office, someone who's suspected of threatening to commit suicide, coming in and saying, well, that gun's my property, return it to me. And there's no provision whereby that can be stopped. It would seem to me also that it might be well to do on a larger scale, which many circuit judges do now when they place a man on probation. A condition of the probation quite often is that you will not possess a gun during the period of your probation. I don't feel that it would be unreasonable to have some special legislation whereby an individual found to be emotionally unstable on proper protection and showing being prohibited from the use of any firearm. I think those suggestions are constructive. I think a much better approach to the problem than any gun registration or any licensing would be. If any of you have questions, I'd be glad to respond.
Any questions? Don?
You're not opposed then to the idea that there are a number of people in our society that shouldn't have guns?
Oh, absolutely not. We have to face that as a fact. Emotionally unstable people, and I would even go one step further, untrained people. I'm happy to say that we have 3,890 under safety instruction instructors. I think that the hunter safety instruction is one of the best things we've ever had. But I agree with you absolutely that untrained people, emotionally unstable people, should not have a gun.
I'm familiar with your hunter safety program. I used to be the sheriff of Multnomah County, and our reserve program sponsored
NRA program for rifle training to people, younger people. And it was my feeling then that probably nobody should have access to a firearm that hadn't been through a similar training. I think it's a very worthwhile training. I think that was a possibility that everybody should have some kind of training in firearm use.
If it were possible to do it, I think we have absolutely a step in the right direction with this hunter safety education. Frankly, I don't like to be out in the field hunting with anybody who is not familiar with firearms, knows their use and their potential danger.
You know, like somebody driving a car that hasn't had any training in driving a car.
Chairman,
Judge Burns.
Question. Mr. Crawford, you indicated that your group would perhaps favor a central filing as to permits for the use of concealed weapons.
Yes.
I'd like to ask you this question. What, if any, position does your group have on whether there should be central issuance? In other words, lodging, for example, the power of issuance in the, let's say, state police, and removing that power from the sheriffs and the chiefs of police, or lodging the issuing power exclusively in one agency or group of agencies?
Well, that matter has not been discussed with the group. I personally would not favor it, and then I feel the local sheriff is in a better position to judge than any central agency.
Would you favor then removing that power from the chiefs of police?
No, I don't think so. They are in a good position to know whether an individual should have a permit or should not.
The reason I ask that, there was some indication in our subcommittee meeting, perhaps with other discussions that I've been at, that because the policies differ widely, and even in some counties, you will have a sheriff who is very restrictive on issuance, and the chief of police who is very liberal. It has been suggested that this is an anomalous situation, and I wanted to see if you had any comments on it.
Well, I'm of course aware that some sheriffs have simply taken the position they will not issue such a permit, and if I took any position on that, I would say that a refusal to issue a permit perhaps should be reviewed by the circuit judge.
Of course, Mr. Chairman, every time they mention the circuit judge, a shiver goes up my spine.
That's my tooth.
You know, Mr. Crawford, one of the aims or directions that this commission is taking is to eliminate the passage of special statutes for special area. You say to provide, to recommend it providing a special statute for stealing of firearms. Well, we'd have the cattlemen in here, special statute for stealing of cattle. The railroads for a special statute or enhanced penalty for breaking into a boxcar. The telephone people with respect to breaking into a coin box of a telephone. And we'd actually be going completely away from the goal or the direction that we're attempting for 3 years now, been attempting to follow by accepting your suggestion.
So I can see where that could perhaps open Pandora's box for you. But here's my point is, what we really want to accomplish is to get the guns out of the hands of the wrong people. And my experience as an attorney, guns in the hands of the wrong people have quite often been stolen guns.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Crawford, one of the things that concerns me about this entire question of firearms legislation is the matter of the increasing number of unsolved homicides which we have. We have several in Multnomah County, we have several in Lane County, and there are those who say that
were we to go to a system of firearms registration with ballistical information as part of the registration that is taken, whatever you do, ballistics test on the gun that you register, that while it might not reduce or eliminate, certainly wouldn't eliminate, might not reduce the incidence of firearms deaths, it would immeasurably aid the police in trying to solve these through the science of ballistics. Now, has your association taken a position on this aspect of the question, and if not, do you feel that there's any merit to it?
Well, I don't feel that there's any merit to it. Now, of course, fingerprint registration has been quite practical because they can be classified. I don't know of any way of classifying bullet registration, perhaps other than by caliber, and you'd have an impossible situation of comparing a murder bullet with, say, 100,000 samples. I don't think there'd be any merit in it on that grounds. And anyone at all skilled and knowledgeable about firearms could change the ballistic reading of a gun by simply putting a few emery paper patches to it. I don't think there's going to be any merit in that at all, Senator.
Mr. Crawford, aside from the cost, and incidentally on the cost, I have 7 or 8 guns. I don't see how and you say that you assume if there are 500,000 hunters, each of them has a .22 high-powered rifle and a shotgun. I don't see how the cost could be so great just to register those guns. I could do it all at one time.
Well, it probably would go to annual registration, but I wasn't able to get the figure, Senator, but I'm sure you can, as to how much it costs the state to register both, and then compare it to the number of guns.
I think it's a different situation because very few people have 7 or 8 boats, but they do guns. Do you think there's anything wrong with some authority in the state having the information with respect to where every gun is in the state?
Nothing basically wrong, but...
Aside from the cost.
The cost and the unlikelihood that it would accomplish any beneficial result.
Ms. Perry, I don't recall any thing in your presentation that calls for annual or periodic registration. Is there something that...
Well, first of all, there's a confusion between registration and license. And
yes.
Registration only registered.
It's one time.
Now, this would be a one-time thing, unless that gun were, of course, transferred.
Yeah.
Then the owner would have to register. All the facts we have is that it costs about 25 cents for the process of registration across the country. And the license is about $5, $6, $7
How often?
Well, we recommend every 5 years. It should be reviewed at some period because the history that the New York State has had with their Sullivan Law is these permits were given for a lifetime, and they found that so many of the circumstances changed that unless you review them periodically, it would be useless. But the Illinois does it for about $5 per license, which lasts for 5 years.
Representative Carson? Yes.
When on the 25 cents, that would just be you'd probably go into the receipt and fill it out. It would be no ballistics check.
No, that's just the recording of the name.
The name, the number, and
yeah,
serial number of the weapon.
The ballistic check is quite expensive.
I would imagine.
That's why that hasn't been recommended.
Any further? Representative Haas?
I think we say it several times that we've accomplished too much. Didn't mean that in Philadelphia after they had their registration and their license, wasn't there a dramatic drop in from the substance abuse problems.
I don't have the information, I'm sorry. But in Washington, D.C., where they've been trying that type of controls, lawyers I have known for over 20 years told me whatever else I did to stay off the street after dark, and I came to the conclusion myself that standing looking into a store window with my back to the sidewalk was a poor idea in daylight. And it was knives that were used for robberies there, primarily.
Can I
disagree with you that if fires were not involved in the group, they were not in cause of death, but there were fires involved. One of the things people know to oppose to fire registration is the bumper sticker, the checks registered there. Is that the position of the Rifle Association, or is it the Rifle Association opposed to the
Basically, because of the inconvenience that involved, of course, anti-gun proponents have stated publicly that they advocate confiscation of all firearms in the hands of the civilian population. But I'm sure Oregon is not ready to ever seriously consider, at least at this time.
Any further questions? Yes, Tom.
You mentioned, and this concerns me both, not just your presentation, but the Kennedy Action Plan presentation, that the primary purpose, which you both seem to see, is to keep the guns out of the hands of, quote, improper persons, unquote. We do have categories such as ex-convicts already set up. But I see no firm standards. What standards would you impose to determine whether you're a proper person or not?
Well, first, I think everyone is entitled to the presumption that he's a proper person unless he falls in one of the prohibited categories. And then you would limit it to prohibiting the ownership of a gun to one who's proved himself to be emotionally unstable to have and use it.
We have various degrees of instability. A person who's been committed to the state hospital may be cured. A person who occasionally sees some psychiatrist may be unstable. How would we have any cross-check with you?
But the question really for a psychiatrist and a doctor to form a standard, so I wouldn't be confident to do it.
I was just wondering whether every person
that would be
interested in the same place I
can. Oh, I think it could go the other way. I think it should go definitely the other way, that burden should be on the state to say you are not competent to have a gun. It should be the other way rather than the individual having to prove his fitness.
That's a basic disagreement.
I think basically that is part of the disagreement.
Mr. Crawford, I'm not being entirely facetious here. If that were that step was taken, would the instability be established under the Naughton rule, or the Durham rule, or the Montana Code rule, or what?
Well, if I were laying down the rules, I'd do pretty much the way the circuit judge does when he puts somebody on probation for 2 years. He decides he shouldn't have a gun, not possessing one is part of his probation.
I would suspect that either Massachusetts, New Jersey, or Pennsylvania, or one of the other states certainly have some standards with respect to this area. Are there any further questions?
Just one quick one, Mr. Chairman. Does your association make any differentiation between handguns and rifles in the feeling?
Well, basically not. Our primary weapon of target practice are handguns.
Ms. Perry, you were attempting to say something.
Yes, was always going to answer this question. The categories that we recommend would be very objective categories to try to establish some means of judging whether a person is unstable. And if you say that he has been spent time in an institution and the bill that we proposed last year, there would be the ability for the person, if he had been cured, to go to the doctor. Be judged cured, all right. So it wouldn't be the thing you would serve either time as a felon or as a non-legal person who would ever be able to have a gun. I have a very interesting article here by the president, past president of the ACLU, who testified on the gun law in Washington, and he makes very good suggestions on how these categories could be set up. So they wouldn't be arbitrary, so there could be some judgment made on this. So there are guidelines for that. Secondly, I was just reading Mr. Crawford, who said the gun laws don't do any good. I think our report finally shows before and after studies, cities which have enacted gun laws, strong gun laws, and the percentages are there in black and white. And Toledo is probably more dramatic very recently. Within a year after the enactment of the gun law, all violent crime dropped 31% on the national average. All crimes in prison, 9% that particular period. All robbery by gun dropped 54%, while robberies in general dropped 33%. All aggravated assault involving firearms dropped 45%, 1 year after enacting the law. In Detroit, on the other hand, after the riots, there was a great increase in gun purchases and murders there. The number of new purchases of permits issued in a two-year period rose something like 3 times, like 6,000 to 17,000 new guns, handgun permits that year. And the murder rate in that period went up 400%. So there are statistics done by research firms, many of them by the Violence Commission especially, and they show that there is a relationship between the number of guns and the type of laws and the violent crime rate.
Any further questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Robert.
Senator.
Thank you, gentlemen. The witnesses. This is rather a volatile subject, and I'm sure if the commission were to undertake determination of its policy in this area today, that we wouldn't even reach the remainder of our agenda. So we'll wait to see how we stand at the end of the day, and if we have time, we'll resume consideration of this. If not, it will be considered a subsequent meeting. So now, let us now turn to item three, offenses.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Captain Howard of the State Police. His name would be here today, but his able assistant, Lieutenant Gene Doherty, is here. I wonder if he would have any comments on this.
I had asked him earlier if he wanted to testify. He said not.
No comments, Frank. The rest of the spectators.
And you can speak in committee of your views.
Such as they are.
Mr. Chairman, I am not going to be able to be here this afternoon, and I'm most interested in being here if this does come back up. I wonder if it was possible that it could be held at the next meeting.
You won't be able to be here this afternoon?
I will not be able to be here this afternoon.
No, we'll be here. Yes, we'll defer action on it until you are here. Eventually have to be considered.
Well, the difficulty we get into is that the subcommittee cannot proceed in this area of firearms until we get a decision from the commission.
Maybe we can go to the next one. Item three.
Oh, I guess right.
You can. And your eyes are red.
Mr. Chairman, item three. Now we're talking about some amendments to our draft on offenses against privacy of communication. This is the wiretap area we discussed previously, and Roger has gone back through and using the Omnibus Crime Control Act that Title III of that Act, and the changes in Title 18 of the U.S. Code, which incorporate the wiretap provisions of the Omnibus Crime Control Act, and also in using the revised, that is, the amended New York statutes in this area, we've attempted to come up with what we hope is a draft, that is, assuming that the Commission wants to provide for some sort of legalized wiretap in this area. Assuming that you want to do that, we've attempted to put together a draft that meets the requirements of the Omnibus Crime Control Act, and would hopefully be constitutional as well as legal. Of course, the constitutionality of this area is unsettled, and it probably will remain unsettled until the Supreme Court makes some determination as to the constitutionality of Title III of the Omnibus Crime Control Act. But in any event, this material is in your book, and the amendments, I think we have two sets of amendments. The amendments begin under the green tab, which appears in your book. And I'll let Roger go ahead and discuss this area. There are a couple of places where we do differ from the New York proposal, and we'll point those out to you. Roger, why don't you go ahead?
Well, pages 1-4 reflect the amendments recommended by the Commission during the meeting of January the 10th of this year. On the first page in section 2, subsection 1, the underlying portion is an addition to our preliminary draft number 2. In other words, we have made an exception in the case of peace officers or those acting under their direction to record or overhear conversations where such person is a party to the communication or one of the parties to the communication and give prior consent to such each. This is consistent with the new federal law, Title 18. They also allow make this exception.
Before adopting this amendment, it might be wise to correct the typographical error. Records of conservation.
Well, it's going to be big this year.
Where are you at?
Sub 1, over here is a records of conservation by me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
By the
Criminal
Evasion
Commission. Yeah. That's a little more accurate. Tell Tom that he's putting in the commentary.
I have a question.
Where is it? Privacy communication.
Oh, you better run down. Well, that Roger does about
the question I have, Mr. Chairman, is this. If you permit a police officer to overhear or record a conversation. Now, this is a non-phone conversation, as I understand it.
Yep.
Now, do we have similar permission to permit a police officer to overhear and record a telephone conversation?
Yes, because under subsection 2, if you have the consent of one of the persons engaged in communication.
No, wait a minute. Subsection 2 requires consent of one of the parties. Your typical wiretapping situation where the police wish to wiretap, they do not have the consent of either of the parties.
This prostitute case that the Court of Appeals recently decided, where...
That's State versus Young.
Yeah, in
that instance, the police officer had the...
tape recorder.
Yeah, and he had the consent of one of the participants to the conversation.
Well, that's what this is talking about.
If you're just talking about the police wanting to wiretap put a bugging device of some sort on the telephone line, they're going to have a warrant. And that's provided for.
Oh, all right. Excuse me.
It's no longer one party.
Yes, continues to be one party consent.
Would you still
have
to have a warrant?
No, you don't have to have a warrant if one party, but the situation where you don't have one party consenting, then you've got to get your warrant.
And this would be true where you seek to overhear either type of communication, either phone or non-phone. If the police officer wishes to overhear it without any consent of anybody, he has to have a warrant, whether it be a phone conversation or a room conversation.
If he wants to record it, if he just wants to listen and doesn't use a eavesdropping device, he can sneak around and listen with his ear, but he can't record it.
I'm going to point out, connect to the subject.